From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. One year ago, a storm on Mount Everest took the lives of 9 climbers in one day. One of the survivors, journalist John Krakauer, has written a new book about the disaster. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear the interview we recorded last May, just a few days after Krakauer returned home from Mount Everest. And we'll phone him to see how he's dealing with the disaster one year later. Also, from the archives, chess master Garry Kasparov talks about what he learned from his victory last year over the IBM computer Deep Blue. Now 4 games into their rematch, they're tied. Film critic John Powers reviews The Fifth Element, a new sci-fi film starring Bruce Willis. And we celebrate our 10th anniversary with a song by Dave Frischberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The United Nations Committee Against Torture says some interrogating methods used by Israel amount to torture. Owen Bennett Jones reports from Geneva.
The committee said that Israel's interrogation practices should cease immediately. The Israeli government says its guidelines on interrogations provide for limited forms of pressure under very specific circumstances, although the exact forms of physical pressure are secret. The committee said those guidelines should be published in full. The committee said it believed the sanctioned techniques include hooding suspects, shaking them, making death threats, and sleep deprivation. The UN committee said it acknowledges the terrible dilemma that Israel faces in dealing with terrorist threats. But under the terms of the convention, no exceptional circumstances can be used to justify torture, and the committee concluded that Israel is in breach of the convention despite being a signatory to it. For National Public Radio, this is Owen Bennett Jones in Geneva.
Israeli and Palestinian officials met today to discuss security matters for the first time in several weeks. U.S. Envoy Dennis Ross continues his efforts to bring the two sides together at a higher level to talk peace. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told his cabinet today the security meeting could lead to a resumption of direct contacts. For a time today in Venice, Italy, 6 armed men seized the bell tower in St. Mark's Square. They were demanding autonomy from Italy for the city of Venice. It ended abruptly when Italian commandos scaled the 324-foot tower and captured the men inside the tower and 2 alleged accomplices just outside. The Northern League Party, which advocates autonomy, said the suspects were not connected to that group. The city's chief prosecutor called them crazies. In the trial of Oklahoma City bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh, prosecutors called a witness who said he saw McVeigh driving a rival rental truck. But on cross-examination, defense attorney Stephen Jones was able to shake the witness's testimony. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports from Denver.
19-year-old Eric McGowan and his mother run the Dreamland Motel in Junction City, Kansas. That's where prosecutors allege Timothy McVeigh was staying when he rented the Ryder truck that was used to blow up the federal office building. McGowan told the jury that he saw McVeigh driving the Ryder truck in the motel parking lot a few days before the bombing. Prosecutors allege that McVeigh rented the truck on Monday, April 17th. But on cross-examination, Jones brought out that McGowan initially told the FBI that he saw McVeigh in the truck at the motel the day before. On the stand, McGowan tried to backtrack, saying he never had been sure which day he saw the truck, but Jones bore in and succeeded in completely flustering the prosecution witness. In Denver, I'm Wade Goodwin reporting.
On Wall Street this hour, the Dow is down 15.5 points at 71.21 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down fractionally at 1330. This is National Public Radio News. Although the Dow is down now, it started the day going up. In fact, the stock market has had a volatile session this morning. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
The Dow rose 50 points within the first half hour of trading today after Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan suggested that central bankers might leave interest rates unchanged at this month's policy meeting. But those remarks are being offset by weakness in the dollar, which is down for a fourth straight session. Overseas investors in particular are concerned that a falling dollar will erode their gains in U.S. financial assets. The dollar is near a 3-month low on speculation that German and Japanese central banks may take measures to halt the dollar's 2-year rally. I'm Doug Krisner.
Workers for Goodyear Tire and Rubber are back at work after overwhelmingly approving a new contract. The strike began April the 20th. The 6-year pact is the longest master contract in the history of the tire industry, which traditionally offers pacts of 3 years or fewer. BreeX Minerals has filed for bankruptcy protection. That's the Canadian mining company that had to admit that its gold strike in Indonesia was a hoax. BreeX also removed its shares from trading on the Nasdaq stock market and fired the geologist who was in charge of the project. Company officials had claimed that there could be 200 million ounces of gold at a site in Borneo, which would have been the biggest gold deposit ever found. John Felderhoff, the senior vice president for exploration for BreeX, still insists that there is gold there at that site. He sold off some of his shares for millions of dollars. He now lives in an estate in the Caribbean. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other National Public Radio member stations and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow marks the first anniversary of the storm on Mount Everest that killed 9 climbers from 4 expeditions in one day. 3 more climbers died by the end of the month. That was the most deaths in any one incident on the world's highest mountain. Journalist John Krakauer is one of the climbers who survived the storm. He was on assignment for Outside Magazine, writing about a new phenomenon, the guided climb, in which an expedition of high-paying amateurs is led by an experienced guide. The guide on the expedition Krakauer was writing about, Rob Hall, died in the storm. This was Krakauer's first time on Everest, but he's an experienced climber who has written about the danger and exhilaration of high-risk adventure. Now he has a new book about the Everest disaster called Into Thin Air. In Krakauer's expedition, 4 of the 6 people who made it to the top died. The 5th was severely frostbitten. Krakauer was the only one who survived without injury. I spoke with him last May, just a few days after he returned home to Seattle from the climb. I asked him why he thought he survived.
I don't know this. I mean, this is something that's haunted me since it happened. I mean, I would like to say that, you know, I was more experienced than the other clients or smarter or something, but I think when it comes down to it, I was just lucky. I've gone over it hundreds of times in my mind. I mean, there's some things I had in my favor, but the people who died, I mean, Rob Hall, much stronger climber than I am, another guide named Andy Harris. So I can't tell you. I mean, it's one of those things. Some people lived and some people died is... it's a mystery that I think will trouble me for some time to come.
John, what were the first signs that you saw that a storm was coming?
It was when I reached the summit or shortly thereafter. You have to remember that all this is happening, you know, at 28, 29,000 feet. You're using bottled oxygen, but that brings the altitude effectively to maybe 27,000 feet. So you're hypoxic. Your brain is oxygen starved. And the effect of that is... it's impossible to think clearly at that altitude. The whole thing seems like we were underwater. I mean, it was sort of dreamy and drugged in retrospect, things that should have seemed obvious at the time just didn't hit. And I remember getting to the summit and turning around and seeing clouds rising out of the valley. Since you're up higher than anything else, you're above most of the storm clouds. We were above the storm clouds. There's a lot of blue sky. It wasn't until the clouds rose rose to the level of the summit and engulfed us that we realized, oh, the weather's turning bad. I mean, if we'd looked down and were thinking clearly, we could have seen it. But it wasn't until all of a sudden the clouds are over us, they've enveloped the mountain, it's a whiteout, it's starting to snow, that people began to realize, oh, this perfect day. And it started out as a perfect day, perfect conditions, perfect weather. That's when we began to realize, oh, we better get down fast.
Where were you and what time was it when you had this realization?
This was, again, I reached the summit about 1 o'clock. There were about 30 people, maybe a little less than that, climbing that day that set out from the camp at the South Col at 26,000 feet. We started climbing at 11:30 at night. So for the first 5-6 hours, we're climbing in darkness. Moon rose over Makalu. It was beautiful. There was enough light from the half moon so we could turn off our headlamps and climb just by the light of the moon. Got to the summit about 1 in the afternoon. I was the second person. I was up in the front about 1 in the afternoon, and that's when the first clouds started moving in. And most of the, I mean, I remember on the way down, I tagged the summit, turned around. I was running out of oxygen, so I was in a hurry. And almost the whole group I passed over the next hour, they were coming up. So we were all sort of bunched together, you know, as high fives along the summit ridge, congratulating each other. There was no sense that anything was going wrong or was about to turn ugly. And then I moved off by myself. I started moving down. I had the experience to climb by myself, so I didn't wait for the part for the rest of the party. I just started heading down, so I was one of the first people down, and I didn't see the group again until we got back down to our camp at the South Col.
So because you were ahead of everybody else, you managed to be ahead of the storm also?
Well, the storm caught me. I mean, by, you know, the storm started, it didn't start violently. It was just this, you know, snow, clouds moved in. Climbers call it a whiteout, where all you can see is cloud. It's really hard to make out any features, but you know, I've been in a thousand storms like that, and all experienced climbers have. And as I got lower and lower in the mountain, the winds picked up until, oh, by 3, 4, 5 in the afternoon, certainly by 4, they were hurricane force winds, just roaring, sounding like a Boeing 747, strong enough to knock you off your feet. I worried that there was so much snow being deposited by the wind that I worried about avalanches. You know, and this is a bitter cold wind, 100 below wind chill, so that any exposed skin, your cheeks, anything freezes very, very fast. And that alarmed me. I mean, I was taking it very seriously by that point, trying not to make a mistake. You know, if your hood falls off, blows off, if it is not buttoned correctly, you're gonna freeze all the skin on your face. So you've got to be really, really careful. And I was. I made it down to just above the camp and paused over an icy section. At that point, I was caught by one of our guides, Andy Harris of New Zealand, who was in bad shape. He was sort of desperate and rushing down, and he passed me. And I saw him walk within 50 feet of the tents, and then the whiteout closed in. I didn't see him. I assumed he was at the tent and that he'd gone to bed. And the next morning, I realized that he never showed up at the tents and went out to look for him at 6 in the morning and spent an hour looking for him. I saw some crampon marks in the ice heading over the 4,000-foot Lhotse face, and I can only assume that he, in the storm and in his exhaustion, instead of taking a left turn for the tents, he kept going straight and walked right off the face. His body was never found.
So when you got down to the camp, was the storm really bad at the camp?
Oh, yeah. It was, you know, even in the camp with all your clothes on and your sleeping bag in a tent, I feared for my life. I mean, the tents are, they're being threatened to, they're, you know, they're being battered. You think they're going to blow apart. You're very cold. You've run out of oxygen. And it's not just, the oxygen also plays a huge part in keeping you warm. The physiology of, I mean, you need oxygen to keep warm. So when the gas turns off and the oxygen turns off, your hands get cold, your feet get cold. So even at camp, it was chaos. You couldn't talk from one tent to the other. No one knew who'd gotten down and who hadn't. Climbers were coming in the middle of the night, just finding a tent and piling into it. There were still, I think, about 10 or 12 climbers out as of midnight. They'd gotten down to the call, to the area of the tents, but they couldn't find the tents. And they were in desperate shape, just barely hanging on to their lives, when one of the guides, Neil Biedelman, happened to, a little after midnight, catch a glimpse of the, you know, like a 15-second glimpse of where the tents were and dash for the tents with anyone who could walk. There were still 5 people left out there who were in such bad shape. They were just lying on the ice, comatose, unable to help themselves. And another guy, a Russian named Anatoly Bukharev, went back and heroically dragged 3 of them back. 2 he couldn't bring back. And one of those, Yasko Namba, died that night. The other, Beck Weathers, rescue party found him in the morning, and in sort of an act of triage, this rescue party found both Beck and this Japanese woman, and they were both barely alive, but they assumed they were going to die, and they were better off just leaving them there. So this rescue party decided to leave these 2 people there, and amazingly, 6 or 8 hours later, Beck Weathers kind of woke up and roused himself and walked into camp, you know, almost blind. He'd lost a mitten. One hand was, you know, completely frozen. This is sort of an amazing tale, how this guy saved himself.
My guest is journalist John Krakauer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with John Krakauer, recorded last May, several days after he returned home from the Mount Everest disaster. When you got back to base camp and realized that some of the other people in your party were not going to make it back, and that they were really trapped in the storm and weren't as capable as you were in getting down, what's the, I don't know if etiquette's the right word here, but what you must have felt like, oh, well, there must be something I could try to do to help them, and yet there was probably nothing you could possibly do. I mean, what goes through your mind about the responsibility toward the others who weren't making it?
Oh, I've gone through a lot of guilt, and I haven't resolved it yet. And that, you know, the night after we got back to our tents, if I'd really had my act together, if any of us had, you know, we could have been out there trying to rescue Yasuko Namba, this Japanese woman, and Beck, and who were at the call, and Yasuko died there. I mean, you know, she was two or three hundred yards away from camp when she died, and so you ask yourself, why didn't I, upon realizing she wasn't there, go out and search for her, search harder for her? I mean, there's a, you know, you have to deal with that a lot. I have to deal with that. It's there are things we could have done and didn't do. I mean, at the time, we were so messed up. You know, it was all I could do to get into my tent and just try to hang on myself. But in retrospect, you ask yourself, gee, maybe I could have saved her life.
But on the other hand, a couple of the leaders of the climb stayed behind to try to save people and died doing it.
Right. Yeah, Rob Hall, I'm sure, died because he stayed behind with a climber from Seattle, Doug Hansen, sort of collapsed on the summit ridge, and Rob stayed behind with him. I remember there was a radio call at 4:30 from base camp to Rob in which they suggested, you know, Doug's a goner. You should leave him and go. And Rob refused to do that. I mean, it, you know, as a professional guide, he couldn't. As a person, he couldn't. And it ended up costing him his life. Rob held on throughout that night and into the next night. He was talking by radio much of that time, and we had considerable hope that he would make it down. We kept urging him, you know, come down, start down, just start down. And he would imply that he would. He said, okay, I'm packing up. And then an hour later, he'd get on the radio, and we realized he hadn't left at all. He'd frostbitten his hands badly. In the upper part of the mountain, there's some technical sections, some ropes you have to descend, and he felt he couldn't safely descend those. So he decided to stay in the hope that a rescue team could come to get him. But that was, I mean, that was crazy. No one could get up. And sometime in the second night, the radio communications ended, and we assume that's when he died.
I guess for someone like Rob Hall, there were really no options. I mean, do you think that if he had tried to make it down the mountain, that because of his frostbitten hands and because of the storm, he never would have made it?
I think he might have. I think that in retrospect, that's what he should have done. I mean, even if he'd fallen, and he might have, better to fall than to stay up there and die. I mean, I don't know. I asked myself, well, what would I have done? And I like to think I would have headed down no matter what. I mean, as long as you're moving, you have a chance to stay up there. I mean, you know, no one could reach him. But he made a decision. I mean, again, he's without oxygen. He's run out of oxygen, you know, 24 hours earlier. He's not thinking as clearly as he might. He just kept saying, I'll be all right. Just send the boys, meaning the Sherpas, send the boys up with a couple thermoses of tea, and I'll be fine. I mean, that's what he kept saying when we'd say, Rob, man, head down. Just start, pack up, go down now. And he would just say, no, can't do it, frostbitten hands. So, you know, that's part of the problem. Rob had really good judgment, and he would lecture us earlier in the trip about the dangers of Everest and how the need to turn around when the weather looks bad, even if you're close to the summit, and how you shouldn't be foolish. And he sort of broke a lot of his own rules, and a lot of it probably has to do with being oxygen starved. I mean, that's all I can think.
Did you go to the memorial service?
There was one at base camp that we held. There's going to be others coming up. So, yeah, at base camp we had this impromptu memorial for the five climbers from our expeditions who died, and it was kind of a depressing, and I don't know, I had trouble with it. I mean, a lot of people stood up there and said, you know, Scott would have wanted us to carry on, and let's not get depressed, and, you know, think about the good things in life, and I it just seemed like you know, I don't know. I didn't buy it. I just thought, I got up and talked about Doug Hansen as this single parent with two kids now who don't have a father, and just sort of said, man, there's a lot more at stake here than just your own life. I mean, I was, you know, sort of addressing the climbers who had yet to go up, and there are some. There are some around the mountain now, and saying, think about Doug before you act rashly.
So I hadn't thought of that. So you thought you had a responsibility to the people who were first going to take the risk, and you're trying to talk some of them out of it.
Well, I don't know what I was trying to do. I was just depressed, and this sort of forced bonhomie, this forced good cheer about, mm-hmm. you know, Scott would have wanted us to carry on and think about, you know, to life and you know, no guts, no glory, or I don't know, this sort of, this good cheer, I just wasn't feeling cheerful. I was feeling severely depressed and maybe inflicted my depression on others. It didn't go over well. I mean, what I said, just sort of people kind of murmured and went on to the next guy. So, I don't know.
We've done several interviews, you and I, and it seems every time we talk, our conversation ends with reflections on high-risk adventure. And I would really like to hear what's going through your mind about that now. And I just want to say, too, that you're coming off of writing a book about somebody, a young man who went into the Alaskan wild and died there, never came out. So you chronicled his story, thought a lot about risk, and now you've just come back from Mount Everest in which, you know, what, 8 people died, and you're one of the ones who survived. So what are you thinking now about how much risk is worth taking for the adventure of mountain climbing or any other outdoor sport?
Right now my head's in a really bad place, and I just think, I mean, I met the kids of Doug Hansen at the airport. I brought back his belongings from Nepal.
These are the kids who, he was a single father, and now he's dead,
right,
and his kids
right,
have no parents.
Right. And, you know, facing them, facing some of the other families of the deceased, risk, to look in their eyes, there's no way risk is worth it. I mean, if you survive and things go well, it's great. There are definitely benefits from taking chances. But right now, it just seems crazy and selfish and, you know, can't be condoned. But having said that, I mean, you know, I look at myself and I feel like sort of one of these, powerless to change. I'm compelled to take risk in the same way that Chris McCandless was the subject of this book. I mean, that book, I explore risk and the impulse to take it and to test yourself. And, I don't really understand the impulse, but I understand it enough to know when it's there, it's sort of irresistible. For some people, it just defines them. It's an integral part of their life. They can't. It's just something they have to do. And I think I might be one of those people. I like to think that as I've gotten older, I've gotten smarter, and the risk is more sort of, you know, in my head or illusory, or I get the same charge without actually taking as much risk. But this Everest thing is really shaking me up. I mean, this is the first trip I've done where anyone died, and I sort of had to look at death at close range. And it's, I don't know, I'll be interested to see what effect it has on me. I don't think I'll quit climbing. I can tell you I don't think I'll ever go back to an 8,000 meter peak, to a big Himalayan peak. There's just too much misery, too much death, not enough pleasure. I mean, the pleasures I get of climbing aren't all risk. You know, a lot of it is just the pleasure of being in the mountains, of moving on steep ground. I mean, there's a lot of joy in climbing normally. And this Everest trip, the ratio of joy to misery was just way too low. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what I'll do, how this will change me. It's way too soon. I just haven't come to grips with much of what happened there. So it'll be interesting to see whether I keep taking chances that I've taken in the past.
You were on Everest on assignment for Outside Magazine. Have you started writing the piece yet?
Haven't, and it's going to be hard to write. I have a lot of research to do still, a lot of phone calls just to try to iron out some details, you know, what happened, talking to other people who are on the trip. So I don't know. Writing is going to be difficult. I mean, I'm really close to the story. I'm really bent about it. I mean, I don't think you can write a piece under those conditions. So somehow I've got to shake myself out of this funk, get over this fever, and come at it from a different angle.
What are you doing to try to shake yourself out of it? Or are you just trying to sit still and give everything time?
I mean, so really, since I got back, I mean, I was okay for about a day. I sort of had this euphoria where I just walked down on the beach near my house with my wife and kind of just kicked back, drank a lot. And then since then, I sort of, this fever came on, and I've just been kind of depressed and spent yesterday in bed. I mean, I guess I've just got to give it a couple days and try to get it out of my system. But I haven't been myself. I've been kind of acting weird, and I don't know. I'll try. If I don't get out of it in a couple days, I'll try something different.
Have you been dreaming about the climb?
Yeah, I've had a lot of, almost every night I have nightmares about it, involving, you know, sometimes just kind of thing, waking up out of breath, gasping, and I keep seeing Andy Harris wandering off into the mists. I mean, I'm troubled by this. This is something. I'm usually pretty well grounded, pretty centered. And this whole experience has really knocked my equilibrium off. So, I don't have a clue yet how to get it back.
John Krakauer recorded last May, shortly after he returned home from Mount Everest. He's just completed a book about the disaster called Into Thin Air. In the second half of our show, we'll phone him to see how he's recovered. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with journalist John Krakauer 1 year after he survived the storm on Mount Everest. Also, chess champion Garry Kasparov describes playing against IBM's Deep Blue. Film critic John Powers reviews The Fifth Element. And we celebrate our 10th anniversary with a song by Dave Frischberg. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We just heard an interview with John Krakauer, recorded several days after he survived the storm on Mount Everest that killed 9 climbers in one day. Krakauer has written a new book about the disaster called Into Thin Air. We phoned him yesterday and asked if he was still depressed and having nightmares.
Well, the nightmares, I dreamed about Everest last night, but they're different. They're not the sitting bolt upright in a cold sweat in the middle of the night kind of things. They're just kind of frustration dreams, and they're not good. The depression, you know, I'm not over this, and I don't really expect to. It's different. I mean, I can't really tell because I'm in the middle of this book tour, so I don't have any free time that where I'm not thinking about it or being asked hard questions about it. So it's kind of changed, and there's still, I just haven't had time to process it yet. And I think that having written the book will eventually help, but it hasn't yet. And some people died who were close to me, and I wouldn't expect to get over that quickly. So I'm just kind of, you know, trying to be patient and hang in there.
You did a lot of research before writing the book, talking to other people about their perspective on the story, other people who were there on Everest. Did it change your perspective on the climb or on what went wrong?
It gave me a better understanding, but there wasn't any, you know, smoking gun that turned up. This isn't, you know, this tragedy, I don't think should be viewed as some sort of scandal trying to find out the villain and who's to blame for this, because all of us who are up there are culpable to some degree, and it, you know, and the tragedy has its roots in sort of ordinary human failings and hubris and sort of striving maybe too far, and that's what caused it. I learned various details. I learned there's a really troubling thing about something I'd got really wrong in the magazine article about one of my friends, one of Rob Hall's guides, Andy Harris, who I'd reported that I thought I'd seen him come to the high camp and return safely, and then he hadn't showed up, and I reported that I thought he had walked off this 4,000-foot precipice. And I based that report on having seen him. You know, he'd sat down next to me and talked to me, and, well, it turns out the person I had that conversation with wasn't Andy Harris at all. I discovered this out in my research after the article was written, and I'd confuse Andy for a guy who looked nothing like him, sounded nothing like him, and to this day, if I hadn't proven it to myself, I would swear that was Andy Harris who I was talking to. I can still picture his ice-covered face and hear the sound of his voice, and that really, you know, disturbed me and upset me. It was actually one of the motivations I had for writing this book, to set the record straight, to correct that error.
When we talked a year ago, you were pretty down on the idea of high-risk adventure.
Right.
What about now?
Well, you know, I came back from Everest really doubting climbing, thinking that maybe it was just a bad thing. You know, and this is something that's at the center of my life. It really is the glue that's held my life together. And so that was kind of upsetting. And since then, I was offered an assignment by National Geographic to go to Antarctica for 2 months to climb, and I accepted it because it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity with some of the best climbers in the world. So I went, and I was really nervous before I went, whether I'd let my partners down or whether I'd just freak out and couldn't climb, but it was actually a really good thing, and the climbing was spectacular. It was low-altitude technical climbing, very, very steep rock walls in this amazing landscape, and it was uneventful. So it sort of reaffirmed my belief that climbing doesn't have to be terrible. It's still, you know, that's the paradox here. Climbing is a really, really rewarding activity precisely because the hazards are real. It matters what you do up there. You have to pay attention. It's, you know, it's life and death, and that makes it really rewarding when it works out. But when it doesn't, there's no way to defend it, and there's no way to explain it. It just seems like horrible. So I don't know. I mean, I'm unable. I guess I'm not proud of the fact that I still climb, but I still do. I certainly will not be going back to Everest or any other high altitude mountain. I mean, I was way out of my league on Everest, and I'm not going back there.
Who isn't out of their league there? Apparently, one of the Sherpa guides fell to his death on Everest this week.
Yeah. Sherpa guiding for a Malaysian team, and one of the guys I wrote about in the book, Mal Duff, leader of a very experienced Himalayan climber, leader of a British expedition, died a week and a half ago at base camp in his sleep. So, Everest, high altitude, above 26,000 feet, to my mind, is a lot like playing Russian roulette. In ordinary climbing, the hazards are apparent. It's steep. It looks scary and really dangerous, but to a large degree, the hazards hinge on your own skill and strength and judgment. You can control whether you're going to survive or not. On Everest, you lose that control. It's at the whim of the elements, and high altitude diseases strike quickly, and they can strike the best climbers in the world as well as the worst. So, you know, the statistics don't lie. For every four people who have summited Everest, one has died. Right now, as we speak, climbers are assembling for their summit pushes. They've done their acclimatization. They're just waiting for a break in the weather. The weather's bad right now, but sometime between May 10th and 12th, there's likely to be another huge crowd all going for the summit at the same time. And among those people are many people who were there last year, some guides and other climbers, David Brashears, who led the IMAX expedition, Ed Viesters, Pete Athens, names that, you know, were part of the events last year, many people who participated in the rescue, and they're there this year, and I'm anxious for them. I'm very anxious, probably maybe more than I need to be, but I can't help that. I'm following things closely.
Do you feel you've become a different kind of climber since Everest? Do you approach climbing differently?
Well, I've only done one serious climbing trip, and I sure...
Antarctica trip.
Yeah, and it was nothing like the climb on Everest. It was amazing, you know, spending four or five nights on this overhanging rock wall. But I certainly was kind of... Yeah, I didn't climb particularly confidently. I was kind of freaked out, and it took me a while to get used to it. Yeah, I look at climbing differently. I mean, I always thought I understood the risks, but I didn't really. I mean, it's one thing to appreciate that you can get killed on some abstract intellectual level, but to have come out of something like what happened on Everest, you know, I look at things pretty differently now. And, you know, and climbing's funny because a lot of it is sort of learning how to deal with fear and sort of block out fear at the appropriate moments, and that's somewhat harder now. I'm real nervous that I'm going to be going to witness some other accident, and that I worry that might. I mean, then I have a hard enough time doing it now, and if that happens, I don't know what. I mean, climbing is important to me. I can't explain it. I mean, it fills a hole that nothing else does, and gives my life some sort of shape, and it's all selfish and doesn't do anybody else any good, but it generally doesn't do anyone else much harm either, or didn't until Everest. So I don't know. I mean, this is stuff, you know, I'm going to wrestle with for a little bit, I suppose.
Well, John, thanks for letting us check in with you, and you know, good luck with the book and your future climbing if you continue to climb.
Thanks. It's a pleasure talking with you.
John Krakauer has written a new book about the disaster on Mount Everest called Into Thin Air. Coming up, Garry Kasparov on his computer opponent. This is Fresh Air. World chess champion Garry Kasparov is matching wits with a computer named Deep Blue. Last year, Kasparov scored a triumph for the human ego when he won his match with the IBM computer. But Deep Blue's programmers studied that match and have since improved the computer. It's running on a faster system, evaluating twice as many chess positions per second than last year. Now, four games into the rematch, Kasparov and Deep Blue are tied. The last two games are tomorrow and Sunday. I spoke with Kasparov last fall and asked him about the computer's approach to chess.
Deep Blue was never designed as a chess computer. In fact, Deep Blue emerged from IBM research of parallel processors. And they recognized by mid-80s, probably late 80s, that chess could give them unique opportunity to try to solve this very important problem in the computing industry, which is to... force parallel processors talk to each other without wasting a lot of energy by just doubling the same results. Deep Blue's way of playing, Deep Blue's style, if you call it, it's quite simple and primitive. You know, it calculates, calculates, and calculates. It's a brute force of calculation. But we faced a phenomenon when quantity was translated into a real quality jump, because suddenly we discovered that on these numbers, ads, and Deep Blue could make per average 100 million positions per second, which is a big number, even for the beginners, for chess fans, or for just some for the general public and for professional players. With these numbers, I realized that Deep Blue was able to solve some positional problems because it saw so deep and it could avoid some short-term positional mistakes. I'm not talking, of course, about tactics. You know, it's so sharp and so precise. Now they are working very hard to get some chess knowledge into the machine to make this machine more fit for a real chess challenge. And in fact, we'll face very soon a super powerful version of Deep Blue. And next May, when I play it again, it will not be easy at all.
Now, how does computer logic differ from human logic in playing chess?
I think the biggest difference between human player and computer is flexibility. Because when we play chess, we cannot calculate everything to the very end. We have to make selection of the move based on some very subjective factors. We have to evaluate the position. We have to look three, four, five moves ahead as far as we can, and to find out from our perspectives what could be the net result of different route we're going to take. There are many, many factors that we have to take into account. But I know, and all my human opponents, they know that these factors, even some of them are dominant, in many positions can lose their importance. That's why we can easily reshuffle these factors, these priorities, and we are evaluating position using our intuition rather than a pure mathematical calculation. Now, when computer is doing the same exercise and it just it calculates a line and it goes to the end of the line and has to evaluate the final position, computer has a set of priorities built up by the programmers. And this is a fixed set of priorities. That's important to understand. It's if number one priority is a pawn structure, number two is the position of the king, I mean safety of the king, it will always be number one and number two, even if these factors are less important in a very special position that could arise in the middle of the complicated line. That's why computer is not able to reshuffle these priorities. And the moment you realize the way machine thinks, the way machine makes decisions, machine is very vulnerable to your strategy, because I can change my strategy. I can shift from one strategical route to another. Machine is not capable of doing so. Also, during the match, the six games match, programmers, they don't have any time to change these priorities. That's why it will take them 2, 3, 4, 5 months in the lab when they can learn the lessons of the previous match and then to change the machine to set up new priorities. But, you know, at the end of the day, the flexibility is a big, big problem for the machine.
Did you feel like you were representing mankind against machine, and that if you lost, it would be a defeat for mankind, and if you won, a triumph for the human being?
I don't think we can talk about the triumph, because the machines are getting better and better. That's why even if,
right.
if
the battle's not over yet.
Yeah, exactly. If it's a triumph, it's very temporarily. But the defeat could be quite disastrous, and that's why the pressure on my shoulders, the psychological pressure was much higher than a normal chess event, because when I play a world championship match, I can lose my title, which is important for myself. It's important for my relatives, my friends. Some time is important for chess. But playing machine, I represented a very, very, I wouldn't say the whole mankind, but definitely many, many people that believe that human's integrity and human superiority was in danger.
Okay, so here you have all the psychological pressure on you, even more pressure than when you're defending your title against another person. And yet you can't psych out a machine in the way you can psych out an opponent. You can't look at the machine and expect to intimidate them with your look. You can't analyze the computer's face and see where are their vulnerabilities today.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, any outside psychological factors working against me, because machine doesn't tire, machine doesn't care about the weather, about the noisy public, about the press, you know, about just any other factor will work against me because I'm a human being and I'm exposed to some disturbances during the event. But as I said already, machine is not flexible. And again, the moment I know the characteristics of my opponent, I feel very comfortable, very confident, because I know this opponent now, it's like an open book for me. When I have a human opponent, I will never enjoy the same privilege. The question is whether I will be able in next May to do the same within the first two games. I mean, just to get all information from these games, to analyze that, and to make a new portrait of my opponent. Because the disadvantage of the first match and also the second one, that I do not have access to any game played by Deep Blue. That's why, you know, I have to prepare myself for the opponent without any available information.
Now, what do you do in a chess match to keep up your concentration and to prevent frustration or any other emotion from interfering with your game?
No, it's absolutely impossible to keep frustration out of you or the whole match. I do my best, but even in a match against Deep Blue, I was frustrated a couple of times. And in game four, for instance, when I was a crack on the computer and just it didn't work for about 15 minutes and just I lost the signal and whatsoever. And I was very nervous. It's an obvious frustration. And then I immediately made one mistake, another mistake, and I was very, very close losing again. Luckily, my position was quite good before it happened. That's why I was able to defend that. But it was very, very unpleasant, and I felt pretty bad. And I mean, I learned that whatsoever, I have to keep my concentration and just ignore what's going around. It's doable, yes, to be quiet. If you can concentrate on your opponent, you know, I try to imagine that it's an opponent with some qualities. You know, it could be human being, it could be a machine, but it's just an opponent. And this opponent has such and such and such characteristics. And as I have to take this or that strategic route to play the game, because that will be the best and the most annoying for my opponent. And trying to isolate myself from the nature, physical nature of the opponent, that helps.
Garry Kasparov recorded last fall. This weekend he'll play the last two games in his rematch with Deep Blue. Coming up, John Powers reviews a new sci-fi film starring Bruce Willis. This is Fresh Air. Hollywood rolls out the summer blockbuster season today with a high-tech sci-fi action comedy starring Bruce Willis. John Powers has a review of The Fifth Element.
A few years ago, I asked a well-known European director whether he'd ever thought of working in Hollywood. He said yes, but then added that he'd never do it because he knew it wouldn't work out. It's easy to make a movie in America, he said. What's hard is to make an American movie. Which brings us to The Fifth Element, a goofy new science fiction film by the French director Luc Besson. The movie takes place in a 23rd century where people scud around in jet-powered cars and space stations have become pleasure factories like Vegas. There's one big problem, though. Evil aliens are heading toward Earth with plans of destroying life itself. The one thing that can stop them is a set of four stones, each representing one of the Greek elements, plus a mysterious fifth element, able to unleash the cosmic power of the other four. This fifth element turns out to be Lilu, a punky outer space babe played by Mila Jovovich, one of the rare models who's able to act and look beautiful at the same time. Lilu needs to get the other four elements before they're snatched by a wicked tycoon named Zorg, played by Gary Oldman, whose southern drawl is as thick as a man gargling grits. Luckily, Lilu meets up with Corbin Dallas, a retired soldier who now drives a taxi. This is the film's star, Bruce Willis, who's decked out in yellow hair and his trademark smirk. Corbin becomes Lilu's protector from the moment she literally drops into his cab. And though she doesn't speak in recognizable words, a weird romance starts to develop, beginning when Corbin startles her awake by kissing her as she sleeps.
Hey, lady. Wake up. You're right, you're right. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have done that. It was wrong to kiss you, but he said, wake up gently.
You're right.
I thought you might remember me from the cab. Remember? Bada boom. Big bada boom.
Boom?
Boom. Big bada boom in the cab here. Look, like, I drive a cab. This is me. Corbin Dallas. Corbin. You understand? Here. You take it. Go ahead. You can call me when you learn how to speak English. Just kidding. Kidding.
Over in Europe, Luc Besson, who's best known here for La Femme Nikita, is a superstar director, sort of a Gallic Steven Spielberg. He's nothing if not a crowd pleaser, and he stuffs the fifth element with amusing things. He gives us hot-tempered mercenaries with the heads of dogs and sly monologues on the social benefits of mass destruction. He wins Gary Oldman's funniest performance in ages and serves up an extended shtick involving a black drag queen, played by Chris Tucker, whose exuberant shamelessness eventually makes you laugh. He offers us an African-American president of Earth who speaks in the dialect of a homeboy, and he dwells on the witty costumes of designer Jean-Paul Gaultier, whose clothes suit the year 2259 at least as well as they do 1997. All these goodies, plus the loony lavishness of Besson's conception of the future, kept me amused through most of the film. And yet, at the heart of the movie, something feels terribly off. The trouble is that for all its Hollywood grandiosity, this isn't really an American movie. It's a European copy of an American movie. Although the producers are trumpeting the digital effects, The Fifth Element looks unintentionally cheap and tatty. Next to movies like Batman, Brazil, or Blade Runner, it seems like a big slab of Euro cheese. Worse still, the movie lacks the giddy snap of American pop culture. Pictures like Star Wars or Raiders of the Lost Ark jack us up with their energy and carry us along almost bodily. They hit everything, jokes, stunts, sentimental high notes, right on the emotional button. They're as precisely tooled as the locks at Fort Knox. Besson's cockeyed film is not. It's slow, digressive, and strangely bloated. So caveat emptor, all you fans of Bruce Willis and exploding high-rises. The Fifth Element is being marketed as a big summer blockbuster, but it's essentially a jokey little art film with a case of elephantiasis.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Today we're celebrating an anniversary, our own. Fresh Air premiered as a daily national program 10 years ago. You know how it is when you have an anniversary or a birthday? Sometimes you're assertive enough to hint for a certain gift, and sometimes you're brazen enough to just come out and ask for it. We decided to take the brazen approach and ask a songwriter we love, Dave Frischberg, to write something to help us celebrate our 10th. He titled his song, Fresh Air Fanatic.
Fresh Air hooked up with NPR exactly 10 years ago. So today's the day to toss a bouquet to my favorite radio show. I must write a timely tribute, but what song form shall I choose? Why not just kick back and take a crack at some good old-fashioned 12-bar blues? So here's to you, fresh air of the icing. Like a middle-aged, middle-class Jewish B.B. King. It was 1987 when Fresh Air went coast to coast. Now they're starting year 11 with my favorite talk show host. Yes, I'm a Fresh Air fanatic. Got to have my Terry Gross. She's so crafty and Socratic. No other host comes even close. She can talk to anybody, poet, scientist, or star. Conversation flows because she knows exactly who they are. That's why I'm a Fresh Air fanatic. Got to have my interviews. Terry Gross makes me ecstatic when I hear her murmur, "First the news." Habit. It's much cheaper than cocaine. And when Terry Gross can't make it, they got Marty Moss Cohen. So from a Fresh Air fanatic, happy anniversary number 10. And if you run out of folks to talk to, just play the first 10 years again.
Dave Frischberg performing his new song, Fresh Air Fanatic, to help us celebrate our 10th anniversary. It's taken a lot of people here at WHYY, at NPR, and at member stations around the country to keep us going for 10 years. Our thanks to them. But mostly, we want to thank you for listening. You're the reason we're still here. Fresh Air's executive producer, who has held things together these past 10 years and for many years before that, when Fresh Air was a local show, is the incomparable Danny Miller. For the past 10 years, our incredible guests and reviewers have been brought to us by our incredible producers, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Our technical directors for the past decade have been Joyce Lieberman and Audrey Bentham. The rest of our great staff hasn't been here that long, but heck, I don't hold that against them. Our director, Roberta Shurrock, produced today's show. Alan Tu directed it. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Associate producer Monique Nazareth is the latest addition to our staff. I'm your lucky host, Terry Gross. How do you like that new solo version of our theme played by its composer, Joel Forrester? It will be featured on his forthcoming solo CD next fall.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Crown Publishing Group, publishers of Good Things by the editors of Martha Stewart Living. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Robert Hughes discusses his new book, American Visions, The Epic History of Art in America. It's a companion to his PBS series on American art, which begins later this month. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.